And we are officially starting a new weekly segment every Saturday here on Off the Ball, as our own Neil Tracy takes an in-depth look at every nation involved in the Rugby World Cup later in the year. He's going to speak to an expert and or an ex-player from each country. And here is episode one on Scotland of our new series. It's called Land of the Rising Scrum. Hello and welcome to the road to Japan, where over the course of the summer we are going to be getting ready for the World Cup 2019, the Rugby World Cup 2019 in Japan this autumn. Over the course of the summer, we're going to be looking at every single team that Ireland could potentially be facing over the tournament in Japan, as well as the teams that probably won't be playing as well. First up, we are going to be looking at the first team Ireland are going to be playing, which is Scotland in Yokohama on the 22nd of September. Joining me on the line now is a Scotland legend, 67 Scotland caps, which was then a record when he had retired. Scott Hastings, a veteran of three World Cups and a British and Irish Lion in 1989. Good afternoon, Scott. Thanks for talking to us.
No worries. Lovely to join your programme.
Yeah, I'm going to start. You played in the very first World Cup in New Zealand, Scott, which was a brand new tournament, as we all know, in 1987. It's come a long way since then. When you were going out to New Zealand to play in that very first World Cup in 1987, 22 years ago, how did yourself and the rest of the squad kind of view it in relation to the importance of it? You know, if you consider up until then, it was very much just the Five Nations and, you know, your standard tours down under. Did you think 22 years or, you know, down the line that it was going to be this important?
Yeah, it was kind of a step into the unknown. Of course, it was brought together fairly quickly by the then International Rugby Board. And down in New Zealand, it was, even in those days, it was a long way to get down there, I can tell you. And, you know, it was just, as I said, a kind of step into the unknown. 16 teams were brought together to play in four pools of four. And for me, it was kind of a disappointing tournament. I stepped off the plane and we were straight out on the training paddock. We'd been on the go for 36 hours. I actually pulled my hamstring, but they allowed me to stay on. And I got one game against Romania. I didn't last too long. I think it was about 10 seconds. But as we all know, caps are caps. And but it was a great experience. It was my first trip to New Zealand. And it was once the tournament was up and running, it was a phenomenal experience to be part of it. And of course, the New Zealand rugby community embraced it as just something very, very special. And so it proved. And for me, there was one moment in that tournament that you suddenly realised, wow, we're on the world stage. And it was when John Kirwan scored a try for New Zealand against Italy. It was one of these magical tries. He ran, he fielded a kickoff and ran fully 80 yards, beating Italy. And for me, it suddenly went, wow, this was a moment captured in time that will forever be remembered. And it was certainly a special time. And to say that you played in the inaugural World Cup, I think was very special as well.
Yeah, and like nowadays, obviously, for most teams, it is the be-all and end-all. Teams are always working in these four-year cycles leading up to a World Cup. At the time, though, when you were going out there, did you feel like this was a bit more important than a Five Nations Championship, or was it something where you were kind of testing the waters, you were guinea pigs to see what this tournament was going to be like?
Yeah, I would agree with the sort of analogy that we were almost guinea pigs to test it. It was, you know, this, as I said, it was the step into the unknown. We were unsure about how the whole tournament would shape out. And, you know, we stepped off the plane and got stuck right into, you know, training, you know, flat out. And as I said, I got injured in that original training session. Incidentally, from an Irish point of view, Terry Kingston was part of the Irish squad. The Scotland and Irish and French teams, actually, we flew out on the same flight. And, you know, it took us an age to get there. Terry got injured. He got sent back. I got the luck of the draw and was able to stay and experience New Zealand. But Scotland had a lot of experience within their squad of touring New Zealand. We had a lot of players who played with the Lions in 1983, but also toured there with Scotland. So Scotland sort of almost treated it like a tour. And whilst we were allowed nights out and we golfed and we did what you do in New Zealand and did the river rafting and the shooting, I think if you went out nowadays, you wouldn't actually have as much fun. You'd have to knuckle down into some serious pretty workload. And I think Rugby World Cups now have shown that there's a totally different focus in that, you know, you're playing cup final matches literally every time you go out onto the pitch. And you know, as you mentioned, this four-year cycle, everybody measures the success of a rugby nation by its four-year cycle. And I think going into Japan this year, it's one of the most open World Cups where there's maybe eight teams that could potentially win this World Cup.
The significant World Cup from Scotland's point of view was 4 years later in 1991, which you were a part of as well. Obviously, you didn't have to do as much travelling this time around as well. Most of your matches were based in Murrayfield. You got to the semi-final, which to this point is still the best Scotland have ever done at a tournament, better even than what Ireland have done, only a quarter-final. You had Ireland in the pool stage of that competition as well, along with Japan and Zimbabwe. You won the three of those games. It felt like this time round as well, that game against Ireland was essentially a pool decider to see who would get the top seed going into the last stages.
Yeah, very much so. Scotland had home advantage at that tournament. We played all our games at Murrayfield. But this was also on the back of a Grand Slam season in 1990. So we were full of confidence coming in against the opening game was Japan. And we knew that it would be tricky, and it was, but we managed to get 30-odd points on the board and went on to take, I think it was Zimbabwe, and as you mentioned, it was then Ireland in that pool, that final pool game. But by that time, Scotland had a great game strategy. We knew how to play Ireland. We out-muscled them. We moved the ball quicker. And, you know, we had some great coaches in Jim Telfer and, you know, in Ian McGeoghegan, who were kind of revolutionary at that time. They played to Scotland's strengths. We were very much a rucking side who liked to move the ball fast. And, you know, when Samoa had knocked out Wales in the pool stages,
That opened everything up completely, didn't it?
Absolutely. And we realised that when Samoa came to Murrayfield, they were absolutely focused on trying to take another big scalp. And we knew that the threat, so if you consider, it was Western Samoa, let's not forget.
Only a quarter of Samoa.
Exactly. And, you know, the amazing thing was they were laced full of New Zealanders. Frank Bunce, for example, was my opposite number that day at Murrayfield, who obviously went on and played for the All Blacks with distinction. So they were a very, very strong team. They came with huge belief in themselves. And we actually prepared that game as though we were playing against a New Zealand team. And again, the tactics were slightly changed, that we decided to take Samoa on at their strength, which was the physical side of the game. And it worked an absolute treat. I think that was one of the best 40 minutes of rugby, that opening half, that Scotland really put a marker down and really stifled Samoa. But we knew again that if we won that game, obviously, we're still in the competition, but we had another home game in a semi-final, which was against England. And of course, England had come through a strong pool, but had to go to Paris on the same weekend and beat France, which they did. And it all set us up for a semi-final against England. It was a very, very tight affair. England won that match in the semi by 9-3. And I just feel that Scottish rugby, I think when you look back, the players that played in that game really felt that that was an opportunity blown, because we were very confident at that point in time. But England, having been beaten in the 1990 Grand Slam, came to Murrayfield and literally they outthought Scotland that day. It was a close game. I think it was 9-3 was the final.
9-6, I was looking at it there last night. I'm going to ask you about the game itself in a second. I just want to bring up, though, you mentioned your coaches at the time, Ian McGeoghegan and Jim Telfer. Like two absolutely legendary coaches of the game. I would have always felt, from my point of view, with, you know, the age I am and when I would have been watching rugby, absolute chalk and cheese, though.
You're right. Good cop, bad cop.
Yeah.
Telfer.
And it's no secret which one was which.
Absolutely. And we know from the video that was unearthed in 1997, Living with a Lion.
Yeah.
People got to see the passion that Telfer brought to the rugby game. And of course, before that video, people didn't know him. They knew him from 1983. He coached the Lions down in New Zealand, but very much had been at the heart of the growth of Scottish rugby, the rucking style, the fierce ambition, the drill of the team. And he was very much a hard taskmaster. But he got the best out of rugby players, no matter what level they were at. And then you balance that off with McGeoghegan, who was this kind of visionary figure who would touch on your emotional buttons and you know, really think deeply into the way you played the game and the reason you played the game, your family, your your whole sort of mantra. And he got inside your head, McGeachan, and he inspired you to do things and collectively brought a team together. So the balance was absolutely unique. And so it was proven under Scottish Rugby. Jim had been involved with Scotland's Grand Slam of 1984. He'd also been involved in 1990, and he was involved in that 91 World Cup. So that was his sort of almost his cusp of Scottish Rugby. He had a great grip of that. He had a great grip of the players. And ultimately went on to become that legendary coach in the 1997 series with McGeachan. But great guys, fully inspirational, but thought deeply and hard about the rugby.
I was looking back on the England game last night, and there was one piece with a few of the England players that there was a line in it that jumped out at me from Simon Halliday. He says, "I remember Scott Hastings being verbally very rough." Do you know what that means, Scott?
Gosh, I must have had some expletives going around there.
But there was no love lost, certainly, between these two teams. Particularly going back to 1990, when you mentioned that Grand Slam game at Murrayfield when England had lost and you had absolutely bullied them that afternoon. So there was, there really was no love lost between the two teams.
No, there wasn't. And they had some fiery characters and some very good players. And you know, one of the antagonistic sort of cogs in their wheel was a certain Brian Moore, and yet, you know, Jeremy Guskett was a big rival of mine. But you know, we went on the tour, and if we meet up nowadays, it's hilarious because we'll all give each other a big hug and have a pint and have a chat about it. But you know, that England team were hugely motivated, and they knew also that when they came to the semi-final, they knew that Scotland had outbullied them, outbustled them, and in the Grand Slam in 1990. And they came looking for a sculpt that day. And they just kind of outthought us. And Rob Andrew kicked brilliantly in that second half. Simon Hodgkinson at full back knew exactly where to pinpoint the ball. 9-6 was the final score. I think my brother at 6-3 in Scotland's favour missed a kick in front of goal. Not that I remind him too often. But it was a scrappy, tense affair. And, you know, it was... ultimately, it was England who went down and played the final at Twickenham against Australia. But it was a hard, hard game to play in. And, you know, England were very physical up front. They were clinical behind, as I said, with Rob Andrews' precision kicking. And it was just one of those tight, tight games that could have gone either way. But ultimately, you know, England took the plaudits on that day.
Did it feel like a tournament you'd left behind, particularly how close that England game was?
Yeah, very much so. We were very confident going into that game, and we perhaps made a few mistakes in that game that allowed England back in. But England played the territory. They got us to concede penalties. They put us under pressure in the scrum. It was a suffocating type of game, and ultimately, from a Scottish perspective, yeah, I think looking back, that was one that got away. That was a real, real chance to get to a final of a Rugby World Cup. And, you know, we felt that if we'd faced Australia, we would have beaten Australia. Where England had played a very tight game of rugby up until that point in time, they got to the final against the Australians. And there was a lot of talk about they opened up their style of rugby. They tried to attack Australia out wide, and in actual fact what they should have done was kept the ball up front and used their pack and used their experience up front and Rob Andrews' kicking game. But ultimately I think they got sucked into the excitement of a Rugby World Cup, and they'll look back and think, well, that was one that they let go.
Looking at the 2019 instalment now, Scotland and Ireland in the same pool, it does, for all the world, without wanting to write off Japan and Samoa, look like that first game in Yokohama is probably going to be the game that you would expect will decide who finishes first and second in the pool, all things going well. How do Scotland stack up heading into this tournament? The Six Nations was a mixed bag. That last 40 minutes against England was outstanding, but there were a few bad days leading up to it as well. How are Scotland looking coming in? I know we're still a few months out, obviously.
I would agree with you. I think let's look at the measuring point, the yardstick, as it were. The Six Nations was a troublesome time. Scotland's game plan came unstuck a little bit. But I think everybody, Irish supporters including, will look to the second half when Scotland came out 31-7 down and scored. try after try, to get five more tries to get themselves into a winning platform by 38 points to 31, only to concede with the last play of the game. And it was the highest ever drawn international in world rugby history. So a magnificent game that shows Scotland at its best, the way that they can attack the ball and play rugby with ball in hand. Ireland will be very, very wary of that. And Ireland have had a little bit of a sort of stranglehold on Scotland's game in recent years. So if Scotland can avoid injuries with their four warm-up internationals coming into this game, I think it could be a really, really tight game. I think Ireland will be, very wary of Scotland's dynamic running. And Scotland will have to come up with a game plan against Joe Smith, because Joe Smith will have his defensive alignment all sorted out. But it will be a cracker of a game, I can tell you. Everything's hinges on that, because if either team lose, they've still got to then go and play Japan. And in Scotland's case, they actually play Japan in the last game of the pool stages. Now, if Japan get beaten by Ireland and win every game through to that Scotland game, then the pressure comes on. If Ireland lose, they have a pressure during the tournament to then beat the host, Japan.
Yeah, that's straight up after the Scotland game as well.
Absolutely. So, and we all know what happened in Japan in
the last
2015. They beat South Africa. And on their day, Japan in their own backyard could play some magnificent rugby and the thing about World Cups is that teams will have their moments where they stress other teams, and if defences are not on top and you allow tries, you allow momentum, I think this World Cup can throw up the odd shock or two, and Samoa are also involved in it as well. So they're going to come to this World Cup well drilled. They've got some great players. And ultimately, on paper, you go Ireland and Scotland should beat Samoa, easily. But this is World Cup, and as I said, there could be a shock or two.
And before I leave you go, one man we are probably expecting to see at some stage during the tournament, Adam Hastings, your nephew, Gavin's son. I'm sure a proud moment for the family in the last year or two, seeing him develop into the player he's becoming.
Yeah, we're really proud of him, the way he's coming. And the feedback that we hear from his coaches is that he applies himself really well. He's got a good game plan on him. He trains hard. He studies the game hard. But also he enjoys the game of rugby. And the Glasgow Warriors, having had a very successful season, and also his confidence from the games he's had, both starting and also coming off the bench for Scotland, he's learning his craft as a 22-year-old playing international rugby. It's a fantastic sport to be involved in. He is understudy. I think people would realise he's understudy to Finn Russell. It might be that Gregor Townsend looks at Finn Russell and Adam as a 10-12 combination, but Adam in his own right knows how to play 10, and he's learning, as I said. And if he can get to the Rugby World Cup, all it takes is one injury and you're in the shot window. So, there's a lot of good stuff happening within Scottish rugby, and there's a lot of optimism going into this Rugby World Cup. And as I said, there's going to be six or eight teams, I think, that can ultimately go through and win this competition. So can't wait. I'll be there with ITV covering the games. And it's a fantastic place to go and visit. I've been over there commentating on Sevens World Rugby out there. I've played out there, and it's a fantastic environment. And I'm sure Japan Rugby World Cup 2019 will be one of the best around.
Gavin, appreciate you taking the time to speak to us. And who knows, we might catch up with you again before the tournament.
Not at all. You can also call me Scott, by the way.
Oh, my God. Scott, thanks a million. Yeah, so that was Scott Hastings on the line with us there, looking back at some of the memories of Scotland's time at the World Cup. We are going to look ahead at the current crop now, though, with Tom English of BBC Sport, an Irishman in Scotland, who's ready to speak to us now. Tom, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I was speaking with Scott Hastings there about, down the years of Scottish rugby at the World Cup in 1991 in particular. I'd have to ask, though, you are probably an expert on those early 90 days, given, the Grudge, that great book you wrote about the 1990 team. I'm sure you do have memories as well of 1991 and would have a good knowledge on it. He was talking about how it was very much the one that Scotland left behind in terms of World Cups, how the door had opened essentially after Samoa had beaten Wales and, were left to play Scotland in the quarterfinal, and all of a sudden it's England at Murrayfield, where they had beaten England a year before. in the Grand Slam game. Very much one that they left behind. And we were speaking about how Scott's brother Gavin obviously would have missed that famous kick to put them 9-6 up in the last 15 minutes.
Yeah, it's a sickener for Scotland. It's as close as they've ever come to make it a final. And that was a great Scotland team. I mean, it was brilliantly coached by McGeachan and Telfer. Not like stellar names, not like the England team of the time or the Australia team at the time, but a really all-round strong side. And, you know, they after they won the Grand Slam in 1990, they went to New Zealand and they came so close, agonizingly close to beating New Zealand in New Zealand. So, I mean, it's a serious team. I think they were good enough, actually. I think they were good enough to win the World Cup that year. Mm. But England, you know, they're all rivals. England had so much to play. They all both had so much to play for. But England, I think, had the extra sting of losing that Grand Slam and the bitterness that caused the upset, which kind of still lingers on to the day, this day, much to my benefit because I wrote the book on it.
And that train of bad luck has kind of bookended their World Cup experiences. 2015, you know, their last moments of that game against Australia, having come from behind to get into the lead, and all of a sudden that controversial penalty, we'll call it, that that was awarded, that Bernard Foley kicked to win the game for Australia. 4 years is a long time to stew over a decision like that, isn't it?
Yeah, I wouldn't say they're stewing on it. You know, it's a different coaching regime there now. A lot of the players are different. But certainly it does linger. It's like Scottish rugby in recent times has been a tale of could've, would've, should've. And that was the ultimate example of it. They got themselves into a winning position, a position that nobody thought that they would be in. You know, a couple of minutes from a World Cup semi-final, having come within a couple of minutes of being knocked out by Samoa in the group stage. So it was unexpected, but they played brilliant rugby in that game. It was really wide open, two teams going at it toe-to-toe, and high controversy at the end, and then the referee running off, not explaining his decision. It was pretty hot and heavy for a few weeks in Scotland after that. But I think they've moved on, I think.
You mentioned there that, you know, recent Scottish history in rugby has been a tale of could've, should've, would've. How much longer can they keep going along that could've, should've, would've train before it gets to the point where they really actually should be at that next level again?
I think they should be at that next level now. But I think the way they play the game, I wonder, are they destined to always be mired in the coulda, woulda, shoulda? Because they're boom or bust. They're not like, say, Ireland at their best. They will churn out victories. They will just find a way of winning. Scotland can on their day, they can beat anybody and they can lose to anybody. They lost to America on their summer tour last summer. And yeah, it was a fairly experimental team, but there was still an awful lot of frontline players in that Scotland side that lost in Houston. But then they can go out and they can beat Australia. They have beaten Ireland. They've beaten Wales. They should have beaten England. Again, could have, would have, should have in the Six Nations just gone. So I think the Gregor Townsend Scotland, if it ever get, I'll be surprised if it ever gets to the consistency required to win a Six Nations Championship. I think they're hot and cold. I think they'll catch teams. I think this is why the World Cup game against Ireland, first up, is a worrying game for Ireland. They will catch teams, but I question whether they will ever have that ruthless efficiency to go through an entire campaign and win it.
It is a brilliant way to kick off that pool stage, though, with the two top teams in Ireland, Scotland, meeting in Yokohama. And as I would have said with Scott earlier on, it's almost like the, you know, without being disrespectful to Japan and Samoa in there as well, it is, you would expect a pool decider to see who is probably going to be playing, you would expect on the other side, New Zealand or South Africa.
Yeah, you would think that. You would think that. But again, I go back to this point that Scotland can beat anybody and lose to anybody. I mean, I was in Japan a couple of summers ago, summer of 2016, and they played two tests against Japan and they fell over the line in both tests. The second test they were losing and it looked like they were going to lose it. And then Greg Laidlaw came off the bench and steered Scotland home, kicked over the penalties, and they just about scraped home. So I think Japan, I suspect Scotland will win that game. The Samoa game is a real concern. Mm. The Ireland game will take care of itself because that's, you know, Scotland are probably not expected to win that game. They'll go hammer and tong. But the Samoa game, they're expected to win. The Japan game, they're expected to win. And sometimes when they're expected to win, they fall in a heap. So it's not a foregone conclusion. It would be very Scottish for them to beat Ireland and then lose to Samoa. I would not discount that completely.
It's probably not the most popular opinion to be putting out there in Scotland, I would say. The game against Japan at it's the last game of the pool stage. That is, if we're saying maybe Scotland lose to Ireland, they might win their way through after that. They might beat Samoa. Japan of Ireland in the second game, maybe they lose to Ireland. They might pick up if they can beat Samoa and win through as well. That last game between Scotland and Japan, that could be a decider to see who comes out alongside Ireland maybe into the quarterfinals. How much pressure would be on Scotland? How much pressure would they feel in such a case? Because you mentioned it's so hard to read what way they are going to be.
Yeah, massive pressure going on there because, you know, the Scottish psyche, they like to play things down. With good reason, they've achieved nothing in the professional era. The last time they won anything was 1999, before the Six Nations became the Six Nations. And that was Jim Telfer's team. That was a long, long time ago. Gregor Townsend was playing in it, not to mind coaching it. So they keep their optimism kind of fairly well hidden, but it is there now. Because they can see a squad, you know, Gregor Townsend a few weeks ago named a 42-man squad, which he will make up to 44 very soon, add another couple of players. And there's really not a lot of passengers. In fact, I can't see any passengers in that 42-man squad. Obviously, it's going to get cut down eventually to 31. 4 years ago, there were four, five, six passengers in the squad, which you thought, you know, that's a break glass in case of emergency option. You really wouldn't want to use that guy. The squad now is far more complete and far more robust than it was then. With that comes optimism. But at the same time, it's a strange kind of optimism because this is a team that's gone through the Six Nations having won one game. Could have, should have beaten Ireland, could have, should have beaten Wales, could have, should have beaten England, having come back from the dead. So it's very, very hard for Scottish fans to know where they are with this team. They really enjoy watching them when they're playing well, because when they're playing well, they're phenomenal. I mean, they score six tries in 45 minutes at Twickenham, and to blow England away was just an awesome sight. But when they're not at it, they're pretty painful to watch. So it is an optimism in Scotland, but it's a very cautious optimism.
I think it's similar to here over the last few years as well. You mentioned there's no passengers in the current Scotland squad. Everyone there is there on merit and is earning their place. But is it a case that we would have seen in the Six Nations when the injuries start? We all know Scotland's best team and how good it can be and how when they are all on song, they're capable of beating anybody. But it did feel during the Six Nations that when the injuries did arrive, that even though the rest of the squad was quite capable, Gregor Townsend didn't really know who he wanted to put into each position. Like, we saw there was a lot of, you know, once Finn Russell was out, there was a lot of chopping and changing, confusion around who is going to be the stand-in out half, for example.
Yeah, I think that's crystallised a little bit now. Adam Hastings, since the Six Nations, has really kicked on. He's really matured as a 10. He's not the finished article by any means, but he's making a lot of good decisions now, whereas before he was a kind of flaky 10. Now he is controlling games. He's looking far more convincing. So I think that 10 position, that backup to Finn Russell, has pretty much been locked down at this stage. They did have at the start of the Six Nations, they had a horrific injury toll. I mean, it was awful. And there's still doubts over a number of them. Duncan Taylor particularly. Now, Duncan Taylor has not played for Scotland since summer 2017, but he is critical. I mean, Gregor Townsend is saying novenas every week on behalf of Duncan Taylor. Saracens centre has played test rugby on the wing, has played test rugby at fullback. He's a phenomenal player, but he is just plagued with injuries. So if he can get him in his squad, he will probably be in the team. And all of a sudden, the kind of weaknesses that they have maybe in the midfield don't look so weak anymore. I think he knows exactly who he wants to pick in his 15 and in his 23. It's just getting them, can he get them on the field? And if he can get them on the field and a confident mood, then Ireland will need to be very, very careful, because Scotland will think they have, in that opening game, they'll think they'll have nothing to lose, and that will make them very, very dangerous.
Yeah, and we would have seen it at times, particularly the last two times they met at Murrayfield, where 2 years ago Scotland beat Ireland, and even this year, even though Ireland won, Scotland did have Ireland rattled for large periods. So they know exactly where they can trouble Ireland. I think that's the crucial part in all this.
Yeah, they can. I mean, they want to play. Townsend is on record. He wants to play the fastest brand of rugby in the world. He doesn't have, you know, if you look at Healy and Furlong, he doesn't have those belligerent ball carrying, ball handling prop forwards. He doesn't have that type of player. So he compensates by just playing it off the cuff, million miles an hour. Very mobile back row, not a huge bruising back row. He doesn't have a Billy Vonapola, he doesn't have a CJ Stander. But they try and play it fast and loose. And when they get it right, second half against Twickenham, they're a sight to behold. Now, when they get it wrong, they're a sight to behold for the opposite reason. So it's just, they're very, very, that's why I say I can't see a Townsend Scotland team winning a Six Nations, because I just don't think they could put together the consistency of performance. But what they can do is they can shoot the lights out on a given day. And that's what makes them very unpredictable, very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Two questions before I leave you go as well now, Tom. We're still a few months out from it. It's early summer yet. Who are the few players who are going to be wrapped up in cotton wool over the next couple of months? And is there anyone really that we haven't seen too much of in a Scotland shirt? You know, is there going to be a bolter maybe in a squad or can have a real impact that we haven't seen too much of yet at test level?
Well, I've all the names written down here. And I would say the possible bolter is Rory Hutchinson from Northampton. He has not played for Scotland. Centre has come on a ton this season for Northampton, and they're raving about him down there. Scotland are not short of good centres, but he's a Gregor Townsend type of player. He's a good defender. He's a good attacker. He'd be the one. I'm not saying he's going to get in the squad, but he'll be close. If Duncan Taylor doesn't make it through succession of injuries, Hutchinson could be the bolter. And if he gets in the squad, he could be good enough to get in the team. Blade Thompson is another one. Again, he's not played for Scotland. A Kiwi. He was called into the November Scotland squad, but then he got injured. He got a succession of bad concussions. Townsend is desperate to get him on the field in these August World Cup warm-up games, because he is a back row forward who can play, but also has got a lot of bulk. So he wants to see him. So he's another one. Those, they'll be the two of the guys who are probably not that familiar that could squeeze their way in.
Mm-hmm. And who's going to be wrapped up in cotton wool over the next couple of months? Finn Russell, obviously. Stuart Hogg?
Stuart Hogg, for sure. Finn Russell, they can't wrap him up in cotton wool because the French have got a hold of him. They wrap him up in pound notes or euros. But once he leaves France, they will wrap him up in cotton wool. Yeah, I mean, he is the guy of all the players in the squad. He's the guy. I'm talking up Hastings, and Hastings is good, but you can't hope to get through a World Cup at any level of success if Finn Russell's not there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Tom, thanks a million for speaking to us.
Pleasure.
Take care. Yeah, Tom English there from BBC Scotland. That's it for the Road to Japan for this week. Up next, we will be looking at the hosts themselves, Japan, Ireland's second opponents in Pool A, until they will speak to